Sorry. The House Transportation Committee is in session, and welcome everybody. The big crowd in the back, we welcome you all, right? And we'll start off today with an informational hearing, and we have an overview of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division and Greg Del Ponte, Administrator. If he can come up and entertain us for a while.
A while, okay. We'll try to be entertaining.
Yeah. Another stirring subject.
Well, you'll be surprised.
No pressure. I'm next to Rhett Berger. I've got my entertainment.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Members of the committee, my name is Greg Delfani. I'm the administrator for ODOT's Motor Carrier Transportation Division. And contrary to what expectations are a little low, but what I have to share with you, I think will be impressive. And I'm reminded of something that I let off last session's Ways and Means testimony with, but I think it's appropriate to begin with. It's a quote from Benjamin Franklin. He said, well done is always better than well said. And I'm going to share with you some things that I think are extraordinarily well done. But in doing so, I'm going to be the first to admit I'm just the messenger, and it's the men and women of ODOT's Motor Carrier Transportation Division that deserve the credit for some of the remarkable things that I'm going to share with you. The Motor Carrier Division supports ODOT's mission by promoting a safe and an efficient and a responsible commercial transportation industry. You have my prepared testimony. I'm not going to read it to you. I'm going to go through it kind of quickly and highlight some of the things that I think are worthy of your note. Our business scope, we regulate a very diverse industry that ranges from the one-man owner-operator all the way up to the large fleets that operate nationwide in interstate traffic throughout the country and even into Canada. We maintain accounts for approximately 24,000 motor carriers operating a combined fleet of 350,000 trucks. And of those, about 9,000 carriers are based in Oregon, and those 9,000 carriers operate about 50,000 trucks that call Oregon home. The division's organized into five major program areas, and they're listed for you as safety and intelligent transportation systems, registration and permit services, truck size and weight enforcement, motor carrier audit, and economic regulation and complaint resolution. I'm going to speak a little bit about each one of those in turn, and I'm going to begin with safety. Highway safety is a top priority for the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. We administer and we enforce state laws, state administrative rules, and federal motor carrier safety regulations that basically govern vehicle mechanical condition, driver eligibility, load securement, proper shipping of hazardous material. We inspect trucks at way stations and along the roadside. We do comprehensive audits of motor carrier operations, driver files, truck files, comprehensive audits at motor carrier terminals. On occasion, when asked to do so by OSP, we also participate in accident investigations. I haven't finished the statistic tally for 2008 year-end results, but the results are close to what we tabulated in 2007. We did a total of 61,349 inspections in 2007. The lion's share of those, almost 40,000, were performed by ODOT staff. The balance were performed by our partnering law enforcement agencies, and of those, the primary participant is the Oregon State Police. We use outcome-based performance measures to guide our use of our available resources in determining how and where we're going to perform those truck and driver inspections. And we have determined that there is a statistical correlation between removing unqualified drivers and reducing truck-at-fault accidents. As more drivers are placed out of service because of critical violations, truck-at-fault accidents decline. We know that the relationship between those two variables is more than random. There is, in fact, a correlation. We know that by using statistical regression analysis and looking at the multiple years of data that we possess. Now, I'll share with you, when I addressed the Ways and Means Committee during the 2007 Legislative Assembly, I shared with them a story that I wasn't particularly proud of, but nevertheless, it was facts. The data we had told us that truck and fall crashes had increased 11% overall in Oregon from 1999 to 2005. On a year-in, year-out basis, truck and fall accidents were slowly creeping up. And as we considered that, it occurred to me that surely there were some factors that were beyond our control. You might include their worsening congestion, adverse weather events, heightened levels of construction associated with our OTIA construction programs. But nevertheless, I committed to that Ways and Means Committee that we would re-examine the information we had, we would reconsider our approach, we would change our tactics, and I was hopeful that I would be able to deliver better news the next occasion I had to report to the Legislative Assembly. But even at that time, it was important to note that Oregon's crash rate experience was 60% lower than the last federally published crash rate. But nevertheless, we committed we'd do better if it was possible to do so. So as I sit here this morning, I'm pleased to be able to tell you that as a result of the changes, when the 2007 calendar year results became final, the truck at fault crash rate had declined for the first time in Oregon since 2001. The state recorded 1,245 truck crashes in 2007, which was down 11% from 1,400 in 2006. The 1,245 truck crashes included 692 truck at fault crashes, and that figure was down 7% from the 751 recorded in 2006. And you might ask, why the difference? It's because I believe that we changed tactics. Part of the testimony that has been passed out for you is a bound edition of the 2007-2009 Safety Action Plan to reduce truck at fault crashes. It's a large document. I encourage you to take it with you and thumb through it when you have a few moments to consider it. But you'll notice it contains nine stated practices of how we were going to go about in the balance of 2007 and continuing through 2008 to change up our game and to employ different tactics to get at the problem of reducing truck and fall crashes. Those nine different areas began with assessing the problem, planning ahead. It refers to the Commercial Vehicle Safety Plan, which is a grant application for a federal grant I'm going to describe in just a few moments called MCSAP, or the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program. We determined that we were going to spend an excess amount of our time focusing on the driver as opposed to the equipment, because our review of the data told us that well over 95% of truck at fault accidents were not the result of a mechanical deficiency. Rather, they were attributable to a driver deficiency or a driver error. Could be driving beyond the allowable hours of service. Could be an unqualified driver not having a CDL. Could be a driving practice, unsafe lane change, following too closely, excessive speed. But we were going to focus on the driver. We were going to rally the partners. We recognized that, especially through our MCSAP grant, we incorporated the efforts of law enforcement agencies acting as our contracted agents to assist us in performing these driver and vehicle inspections. We wanted to help all the enforcement officers, ODOT staff, and law enforcement partners together by giving them better access to safety data that they need to do their job. We got creative. We decided to recognize that the same old strategies were probably going to yield the same old results. And so we got creative and we developed new strategies. You'll read in the book about we engaged something called TACT, borrowed from the state of Washington, targeting aggressive cars and trucks. It's described in the book. We did, throughout 2008, a series of special inspection exercises in February, in April, two during the month of June, one in August, one in October. And these were different than anything that's previously been done in Oregon. We did 5- and 7-day, 24-hour-a-day, continuous enforcement exercises along corridors. It was impossible for truck drivers to avoid us. We couldn't be waited out. We were going to examine logbooks, and we were going to look at drivers that were operating over their hours of service. And we recorded driver out-of-service percentages that sometimes exceeded 30%, the national average being something around 6%. We were very, very effective. We listened up. We used a process I borrowed from my days at GE Capital called Workout. We brought our folks from the field together in Salem. We asked them, what are you seeing of what we're asking you to do? What do you think is working well? What is not working well? What additional tools do you need? What kind of obstacles are in your path? How can we help you be more efficient? As a result of that, we have a piece of legislation that will be introduced that will impact Truck Safety Administration in the state. We encouraged innovators. We've talked to some folks that had some product ideas and innovations in truck design that they believed would lend itself to reducing truck at fault accidents. We've helped those folks. We've educated. We've raised the volume of the truck safety discussion. I don't know, but I would be surprised if some of you have not seen at some point in time during the last 12 months some television news coverage of activities of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. We have, we called it a marquee event strategy. When you deal with offenders and you write a citation or you issue a complaint, you're dealing with one offender at a time. And that's making incremental progress, but when you consider the size of the population you're trying to reach and the behaviors you're trying to change, we decided the media could be our partner in education and outreach. And so we've invited the media to come and to observe and to ride along in the film as our various undertakings have taken us out in the field. And they've put it on television. And so the message, the underlying safety message, is being beamed into Oregonians' living rooms at night as they gather around their television set. AP Wire photo picked up some of the stories, and I think the results speak for themselves. It's always difficult. You know, we live in a multivariable world. I can't tell you that these specific things had that particular outcome. But I will tell you, my belief is, as we close in on the end of 2008, the statistics lag about 3 or 4 months, so I won't have data for 3 or 4 months past the end of 2008. But right now, we're staring down the barrel of a significant decrease in fatalities resulting from truck-at-fault accidents. And if that trend bears out, no one's going to dissuade me that some of the work that's being done by the Oregon Department of Transportation is principally responsible for some one or two Oregonians still coming and going to work and going home to their family at night that might otherwise have been just a statistic and a list of fatalities. We are making a difference in the safety arena. I mentioned the federal grant. It's the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program. It's $2.4 million annually we get from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Agency. And that is shared primarily, $1.6 million of the $2.4 is shared with the Oregon State Police. And Oregon State Police troopers are effective and our key partner in performing on the highway work, where they're looking for that behavior of drivers that I mentioned that led to accidents. They're stopping them. They're doing walk-around vehicle inspections. They're checking driver credentials. They're documenting their work with inspection, which they submit to the department. We reimburse them. They did approximately 16,000 such inspections to garner their $1.6 million. I'd like to move on and talk now about the Green Light program very briefly. Some of you have probably driven by an ODOT installation on the freeway, and you've seen these arms extending out over the freeway lanes, and there's little devices, and you wonder what's going on. Is that a camera? Are they microwaving me? What's going on? That's an automatic vehicle identification device. About a mile upstream, as you're approaching that, there are wire loops in the cement pavement on the freeway. As a truck goes over those embedded wire loops, the wire loops detect the presence of a large metallic body, a truck. It signals ahead, there's a truck coming. The AVI device sends out a burst of communication, RF, and it inquires, is there a truck there? The trucks have a transponder device. One of them is going to come around. That's one version that we're using. It's going to be passed around, and you'll be able to see it. This is another version of that device. It has an adhesive backing on the back. Simply pull it off, and it mounts to the interior of the windshield in the truck cab. There's an audio tone and a light that will flash red or green. As the truck is moving along the freeway at freeway speeds, it's been detected. The AVI device has queried the transponder. The transponder has signaled back with a unique identification number that tells us the motor carrier and the particular vehicle. In a fraction of an instant, we know, is that truck registration paid for? We know something about its safety rating. We know whether or not their highway use tax account is current. We know if any of the other required administrative requirements are in place. As the truck's moving along, still at 65 miles an hour, it's moved over axle sensors. We've now counted the axles, and we've measured the distance between them. Then the truck moves over a steel plate you may have noticed in the freeway. It's called a way in motion. There's a hydraulic load cell underneath the steel plate. When the truck goes over the steel plate, the plate deflects the hydraulic load cell. An algorithm calculates the weight of the axle from the deflection of the plate. Then we measure and calculate the individual weights of the axles, the combined weights of the axle groups, the combined weights of the axle bridge distances, and the total weight of the vehicle. We check if all of those are within lawful specs, and if they are, the last check is the truck's moving at 65 miles an hour, a total of 600 feet, all this is going on. There's an infrared beam across the freeway, and the truck will either break the beam or not. If it breaks the beam, it's over height. If any of those various tests are deficient, this beeps and a red light is flashed. It says stop at the port of entry. If all of those are good, a green light signal is displayed, and there's another audio alert. And the driver's told, you do not have to pull off the freeway. Keep on trucking. Go straight ahead. A lot of technology, but it's significant. It offers us an extraordinary cost avoidance opportunity for the state. When the Woodburn southbound port of entry, as an example, was built decades ago, the original design specification anticipated about 2,500 trucks a day to flow through the facility. Today, there's over 7,000 trucks driving by that freeway station. We could have built a bigger port of entry, bought more right-of-way, put in more static scales, hired more staff, built a longer runway. But instead, using this technology, we're able to do the exact same regulatory checks of every approaching truck that we would have done in that manual fashion with additional staff through the use of technology. But that's not the only benefit. We've partnered with the Department of Environmental Quality, and DEQ has determined that the number of trucks that we're now able to bypass, and it's over half the traffic that goes by the port of entry now, is being bypassed with this technology, which means they don't have to slow down. They don't have to pull off. They don't have to idle in line for 5 or 10 minutes. They don't have to accelerate. They don't have to re-enter the freeway. They have actually measured the pollutants, and there is a 36% to 67% reduction in each of the pollutants monitored, particulate matter, carbon dioxide, nitrogen oxides, etc. We're making a difference in a green kind of way as well as creating a cost avoidance opportunity, all packaged together with an efficient regulatory approach to screening highway trucks for size and weight compliance. And I didn't give you a statistic. There are 4,330 trucking companies that are currently enrolled in our Green Light program. And together, they operate just a little bit over 41,000 trucks, all in our Green Light system. It's extremely popular. I'll move on to the second of the five program areas. commercial vehicle registration. I have about 94 employees working in that section of the department, predominantly in Salem, a few in Portland. I mentioned we maintain accounts for about 24,000 trucking companies, operating a combined 350,000 trucks. What does the registration staff do? Well, I've given you a list of some of the more common duties. They issue or renew 50,000 truck license plates each year. They help issue 178,000 temporary passes and trip permits. They collect $253 million in weight mile taxes and $20 million in Oregon truck registration fees. You can read the list, but that's not my major point. What they do is not necessarily the story I'd like to tell you here as much as how they do it, because we've incorporated some fascinating technology here as well. I don't know if you have heard of it. Trucking Online was one of the first, ODOT was one of the first state agencies to offer an internet-based service that allows customers to go online to transact business. And it's an interesting story. It began back in 1995 when we became the first state agency to start accepting credit cards for transacting business with the state. Initially, that was limited to face-to-face transactions over the counter. From there, we started to do telephone transactions where we accepted credit cards to settle the business. From there, we started to use faxes. The next evolution of the process came in 2002 when we introduced Trucking Online. There's a total of 15,568 companies that have signed up for Trucking Online, and that includes almost 5,000 Oregon-based businesses that have signed up, they've got their PIN number, and they transact business with us online. From January 30th of 2003 through January 21st of 2009, trucking companies and members of the public have completed almost 2 million transactions through our internet service portal. We now have 64 business processes that can be completed online, and we just have some amazing people that work for us in our motor carrier application development section, and they continue to conceive of new ways that this can be expanded and additional product offerings that can be added online. And when you think about it, that's pretty impressive. What used to be a transaction that required someone to get in the car, drive somewhere, stand in line, and work with someone across a customer service counter, or at best make a phone call, get in the queue, and when your turn came, speak to an operator to conduct business, you can now do from the computer in your den or the PC in your business. And there's a practical value to that. Over the years, the motor carrier division has reduced staffing in our registration areas, and we've eliminated 88 FTE. By moving customers from the service counter, from the telephone lines, to the internet. It is an extraordinary cost avoidance opportunity for the state and for the department. Part of the registration staff also issues over-dimension permits. When you see things that are moving down the freeway that look extra wide, extra heavy, extra long, or extra tall, they're moving down the freeway in a manner that we have given them advice on how to do so safely. We route loads. We also manage the work of four third-party agents that assist us in issuing some of the simpler over-dimension permits that are referred to as continuous permits. Similar size loads over the same route over and over and over operate with a continuous permit. Specialized or super loads that operate on a single trip-by-trip basis, ODOT staff generally handle. The last piece of the registration section that I just want to quickly touch on is our freight mobility section. We're now seeing heightened levels of construction all over Oregon, and the department was quick to realize that while the construction was a boon and the work that was to be done was needed, without some foresight and some extra effort, we could create congestion problems and a mobility nightmare for both members of the public and also for the freight industry. And so we have specific staff in our registration section that is working day by day in mitigating those impacts, working with project designers, establishing effective detour routes. We work hand-in-hand with the trucking industry in doing this. We've forged some extremely effective collaborative relationships. And as a result of the work that's being done, we're minimizing delays for the traveling public and for the freight industry, and we're minimizing detouring trucks on through local communities, and it's working well by all reports. The third of the five areas of the division I wanted to quickly summarize for you has to do with truck size and weight enforcement. We employ motor carrier enforcement officers. There is approximately 92 enforcement officers distributed in 8 districts statewide. They work at 87 fixed way stations, 6 ports of entry, dozens of portable scale sites that are just little wide spots, paved areas off the side of the road where we can create temporary work zones and we can weigh trucks. In 2008, officers weighed over 2 million trucks on static scales. In addition, we had all the trucks that were weighed by the green light system through the weigh in motion system that I described. But here's an interesting fact about our size and weight program in Oregon. In February of 2008, Federal Highway Administration officials came in and gave us a robust top-to-bottom inspection review of our truck size and weight enforcement program. And they were so impressed that they invited us to share our programs and our approaches as best practices at a national gathering of size and weight enforcement officials back east during 2008. We've also introduced some interesting technology. You may have seen at some of our scales across the state little side-by-side cameras. And these cameras are there for a specific reason. Our employees don't do on highway enforcement. If a truck drives by a scale, doesn't stop, that's a violation of law. But in order to do something about it, we have to know who they are. So we have these side-by-side cameras mounted now that capture the license plate and capture the name on the side of the truck. We're able to identify the offender, and we have entered into cooperative relationships with district with district attorneys and courts across the country, and we're able to deal with these folks after the fact. It's been extremely effective. Probably the best judge of how effective we have been would be the trucking industry itself. And so there's a website that you can look at. It's called Coops Are Open. Truck drivers use a chicken coop as a metaphor for a state way station. The website's called Coops Are Open. Here's the quote from, I looked up the website yesterday. Here's the advice they offer to truckers all across the country on how to avoid way stations state by state. In Oregon, don't even think about blowing by an Oregon way station. Oregon is spending big bucks, that's not true, to install cameras in the roadway. They'll catch you if you just fly on by. You'll get a citation with a $427 to $2,500 fine in the mail, and you'll have a court appearance to deal with. The latter portion is true. The bit about the big bucks, that's not true. It costs about $8,000 a site. A very effective technology. We have performance measures here in size and weight as well. We know that there's a statistical correlation between the number of truck scaling events that we record and the amount of highway use tax or weight mile tax that our auditors recover. You may wonder, what's the relationship between weighing a truck and successfully auditing and collecting unpaid weight mile tax? Every time a truck is weighed, that's a data point that an auditor uses in determining whether or not a motor carrier is reporting and paying all weight mile tax that's due. Are they reporting their trips? If they're not reporting their trips, they're evading the tax. We get trip records. We look and see if the trips that are reported coincide with our known data about the truck movements. And where there's a discrepancy, there's an auditor. I'll talk more about audit in a moment. We issued in 2008 over 12,000 citations for truck weight violations. There were over 7,000 weight-related warnings. almost 700 citations for size violations. I won't read it to you, but there's an impressive list. We have an effective presence in the field, and by all accounts, Federal Highway Administration, motor carrier industry, and my observation, we have an effective size and weight enforcement program. I'll move now to audit. I'll tell you that some people wonder about the wisdom of investing in an audit program. In a quick calculation, I can tell you that for every dollar we've expended in salaries, in service and supplies, travel expenses, et cetera, over the last 6, 7, 8 years, for every dollar I've spent, I've gotten $1.55 back in audit recovery. So it's a winning proposition. But you might ask yourselves, well, that's not that big a return on the investment. And I would say to you that the $1.55 is not what you should have your eye on. It's the deterrent value of having the auditors there so that a potentially greater loss of revenue might result from evasion at a greater level if the deterrent value wasn't there. So that latter piece is an imponderable. I can't tell you how much would be evaded that isn't being evaded today if there weren't any auditors. The only way I could tell you that is by not having an audit program and then seeing how much we lost. But I can tell you with confidence that it's being run effectively and efficiently. We are getting $1.55 back for every dollar we spend, and we would have significantly greater evasion absent the program. In 2008, auditors actually completed 743 weight mile tax audits. They collected almost $6.5 million in unreported taxes and fees. But that 743 audits is not all they did. They also screened 44,568 accounts to determine which of them required closer scrutiny. In addition to auditing highway use tax and weight mile tax, this same audit group also audits IRP and IFTA. IRP, International Registration Plan, is a base state agreement that Oregon participates in along with every other state. And under the notion of a base state agreement, a motor carrier that's based in Oregon, that operates in many states beyond Oregon, takes care of their registration obligations to all the states they operate in by dealing with their base state, Oregon. Oregon collects registration fees proportionate to the amount of miles each motor carrier travels in the other states and distributes those dollars to the other states. Similarly, motor carriers that are based in other states that have occasion to operate in Oregon pay to their base state whatever amount of Oregon's registration is proportionally due, and the other state forwards it to Oregon. So it's a collaborative relationship between the states. Part of the obligation as being a member in this base state agreement is that we audit that the proper amount of registration fee has been paid by each motor carrier. And so there's a prescribed level of audits that Oregon is obliged to do on behalf of other states. Similarly, IFTA, the International Fuel Tax Agreement. Oregon does not have a fuel tax for heavy trucks. Every other state in the nation does to some degree or another. And the same thing applies. States deal with their base state to discharge their fuel tax obligation to every other state that they operate in. People sometimes believe that the tax is paid where the fuel is purchased, and that's not true. Well, it's true in a sense, but the more accurate statement is the tax is due where the fuel is burned, not where the fuel is purchased. So, in essence, our role is to tally up all the miles these motor carriers travel in all the states they travel, look at the fuel tax rates for those particular states, determine how much fuel was burned in those states, calculate how much taxes actually due those states, determine how much was paid at the pump, and is there a net additional amount due, collect it from the motor carrier, is there an overpayment, refund it to the motor carrier, and then disperse the payments to the other states. Nothing's coming back to Oregon for this because we don't have a fuel tax. However, we couldn't not participate because every interstate motor carrier based in Oregon would be at a competitive disadvantage to not be able to have that kind of an equitable, efficient relationship with their own state. The last area of the division I wanted to comment on is economic regulation and complaint resolution. In the state of Oregon, there remains economic regulation of two components of the transportation industry, and that is household good moving companies and the regular route transport, bus companies. We regulate entry. We have something to say about who can get in the business. We regulate rates, and we regulate routes. And you may ask yourselves, why is the state in the business of regulating entry, rates, and routes? And that's a great conversation we can have sometime. It's a long conversation. But I can tell you that the reasoning is that these are areas, household goods in particular, the average citizen doesn't interact very much with the transportation industry. This is an area where they do. And by regulating entry, the theory is that you are only allowing the necessary number of practitioners to get in the business so that an acceptable level of service is provided at a reasonable rate without excess profit being made by the company, without injury to the consumer. That's the theory. We regulate routes to make certain that the service is universally available. In addition to economic regulation, staff in this unit is responsible for managing the work of a group of inspectors that are involved in a federal program called New Carrier Entrant. The idea here is that in the first 180 days of operation of a new interstate motor carrier, they get a visit from a state official, and we go through a checklist with them of things that they need to do to be good corporate citizens, want to make sure that they understand the rules, understand the laws, have the resources that they need, and we're able to correct early on mistakes or omissions that might get them in regulatory trouble later on down the road. We participate in that federal process. The last piece of work that this staff does is they handle civil monetary complaints that are filed against motor carriers and or individuals for various violations of federal motor carrier safety regulations or matters resulting from audit or registration violations, and they resolve these complaints. If necessary, taking them through a hearings process under the APA, Administrative Procedures Act. A couple of concluding thoughts. We're very invested in customer satisfaction. We're a state agency. We deliver a public service. We're regulators, and yet we are the face of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and so we're interested in how we're doing. Recently, in 2008, for the fifth time in 10 years, we've reached out to our customers with a survey. And in addition to the six benchmarks of customer service that the legislature asked us to ask, we ask a variety of questions to get feedback about how well we're doing and how our people are doing. And in 2008, 89% of all the respondents from 10 customer groups rated the motor carrier division good or excellent in terms of overall service, while another 9% rated us as fair. Over 5,000 surveys were sent by mail. 23% were returned. If you're familiar with surveying, that's a rather high percentage for a response rate. And the results are at the 95% confidence level. So we continue to get a pretty consistent, we're right at 90-92% of good to excellent. I think it's a good statement. The last comment I wanted to make had to do with our participation in regulatory streamlining. If you took a minute and you looked at the mission statement that I reproduced for you on page one, you saw that we were interested in reducing regulatory burdens where appropriate. We're interested in compliance. We're interested in the legitimate economic interests of the motor carrier industry that we regulate. We have a significant presence in the published listing of regulatory streamlining accomplishments that's maintained on the state webpage. I've listed some of what we've done here. But the list is rather impressive to me. And I'd be remiss in closing if I didn't acknowledge that since 1995, we have continually met with a public advisory committee with the industry, the regulated industry. It's called MCTAC, the Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee. And we have a long and storied history of working collaboratively with the legitimate Oregon motor carrier industry. And many of the successes we've brought forward are the result of successful collaboration and, in some instances, even ideas that the industry itself has brought forward. So that concludes my prepared remarks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Representative Berger?
Hi, Greg. Nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Thank you for this report. I learned a ton, and I'm one of a frequent driver between here and Portland and notice every truck because they're a lot bigger than I am. And I appreciate it's given me some confidence for the next trip that because I always worry about those big guys because I'm dependent on their skill in a big way. One of the things that you did say to me, so overall, I'm happy, but one of the things that struck me was your comment that about the regulation of household goods moving companies. Kind of scratching my head over it. And so my question is this. It sounds like one of those things that comes out of, thank you, Bob Russell's coming up, that comes out of something that happened somewhere in the past, and so something happened. And I guess if you could just expand a little bit and tell us why, and do other states do this nationwide, and are we, you know, sort of, obviously Bob Russell has something to say about it.
Well, I mean, if you have a comment on it.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Berger, you ask a timely question.
Thank you.
The state at this time is actually defending a lawsuit that was brought forward by an individual that was operating as a household goods carrier without authority to do so.
Mm-hmm. And kind of caught a piece of that.
And the allegation is made that it's unreasonable for the state to regulate in this fashion. And I think listening to the gentleman and some of his various speaking engagements, he has said, how would you feel if you wanted to be a coffee vendor? And in order to be a coffee vendor, you had to first get Starbucks permission. And on the face of it, in that simple rendition, I imagine he garners quite a lot of sympathy. But if you take a look at the history of transportation and the history of regulation in the country, I anticipated that question might arise, and I have another 30 minutes of prepared remarks.
Yes, Madam Chair, this was not my intention. I am sorry. And you are welcome to come to my office and give me a further vetting.
I was going to suggest that might be the better avenue as opposed to taking the committee's time off with this complex issue that's the subject of current litigation.
And I would love to hear what Mr. Russell has to say.
Sure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. The Oregon Moving and Storage Association is an affiliate of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'm only here because the chair was waving me up. It's kind of interesting. When I started in transportation, it was in 1973, and my family owned a household goods moving company in New Mexico, we did have authority, that's sort of my roots. The theory, all of trucking used to be regulated, and it's the same method of regulation. It was the rates, routes, and services. In 1980, the federal government deregulated interstate trucking, except for household goods. In 1995, Congress preempted the states from regulated trucking, except for household goods. And sort of the theory has been that the household goods movers deal directly with the public, and as Greg said, the public is perceived to be less than a sophisticated consumer of transportation services. So, in large part, the household goods moving regulation is designed for consumer protection. However, it's based on the old method of regulating, which is the entry regulation and the rates and all of that kind of stuff. this subject has been an ongoing discussion with the legislature for a long time because it sort of sticks out there as the one piece that's left. And why do we keep doing it? And should we keep doing it? And each state, they all take different approaches. Some of them regulate like we do. Some of them regulate in different ways on the rate side, the entry side. I mean, it's all over the board. Some have deregulated and re-regulated. It's, there's no easy answer or model that you can point to. I believe that we are going to continue this discussion this session. We have a board of directors meeting on Wednesday. Mr. Dilpani and I are going to be attending to discuss this issue, and I will be happy to come and talk to you individually, but I suspect that we're going to have a group conversation before this is over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can see I stepped right in it, didn't I?
Sure. Representative Widener.
Just wanted to catch on one comment that you had made, Greg. You guys monitored the emissions of the trucks by not stopping them, and it was, did you say 36% you reduced emissions by?
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, we do not do emission testing. However, I was looking into the possibility of getting some carbon offset grant money. And part of that required measuring pollution reduction. And so we cast about looking to see who might help us with that. And it was DEQ that was able to do so. They've done some testing. I actually have a published report I can share with you. But we just extracted some of the summary comments from that. Tests found a 36 to 67% reduction in each of the pollutants monitored, particulate matter, carbon dioxide, nitrogen oxides, carbon monoxide, and hydrocarbons when trucks stayed at highway speed past a weigh station, as opposed to decelerating, exiting, idling, accelerating, and re-entering the freeway. I'm not familiar with how they perform those tests, but I know that we had to wait for them to acquire some special equipment to do so.
I appreciate that because I think this is an issue we're going to be facing as we're dealing with transportation problems, so, and it goes into environmental impact.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. About 2 weeks ago, I received a telephone call from a constituent who explained to me that boatloads of onions from China could make their way through the canal and over to New York very inexpensively, and as the canal gets bigger, there are going to be even more of that type of freight arrangement. And he was pointing out that the size of our trucks that run from Ontario or anywhere in the Northwest to New York cannot possibly compete because the volume that the trucks can carry can't match, from cost of freight standpoint, the low cost that China can import onions through the canal. So he suggested that I ask why we don't have bigger trucks with more axles, reducing the weight, or at least keeping the weight the same, so that, because he points out that the competitive advantage that China will enjoy is directly related to these trucks. Now, so I asked him to stand by while I got some information from various folks, but none of it addressed the competitive disadvantage issue. A lot of it focused on safety, a lot of it focused on damage to highways, but nothing about competitive disadvantage. Could you address that element of his question?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, it's going to sound to you like I'm ducking the question, and perhaps I am, but it is not a matter that the state of Oregon can address because of something known as the federal freeze. States are precluded from increasing truck size and or weights from the point in time in which they were frozen. The limits that are available are listed in Part 658 of Appendix C, and they're frozen. So to have this conversation requires federal movement. There are plenty of folks that make the argument that you make, that not only from a competitive disadvantage, but also from a standpoint of uniformity. Different states have different size and weight regulations, and you might ask, how is that possible when there was a federal freeze? Well, when the federal freeze was placed, they allowed grandfather rights for any particular state that had excess allowances at the time the freeze was put in place. So it can be the case that a perfectly legal load of agricultural goods leaving Idaho at 129,000 pounds and entering Oregon becomes illegal because you crossed a state line. That's federal law. The reality is that we are not allowed to increase a size or a weight law for any load that's going to traverse upon any part of the national network or the federal interstate system. The legislative body does have the ability to create higher legal weights and sizes off the federal system. And in existing statute, there's an exemption for field-loaded agricultural products in Malheur County, as long as they're moving on the local jurisdiction routes, not to include any of the federal routes. Now, you can't get very far on that pattern of roads, but that's an illustration of the latitude that the Legislative Assembly has been able to exercise. Now, there clearly is a national debate and discussion, even at this time, on the federal level, about whether or not, from the perspective of economic competitiveness, that it's reasonable to continue this federal freeze. That's being discussed at the congressional level. And, of course, they have to weigh here now. They're weighing the inadequacy of the current revenues to build new infrastructure, to maintain existing infrastructure, or to pay for necessary preservation. There are groups that are worried about the additional wear and tear the bigger footprints might introduce to the system. But there's a counter argument there that you could add axles and distribute the weight and mitigate the footprint. But then there's another voice in the chorus, and these are the people from safety, and you mentioned them. There are nationally significant groups like the Coalition Against Bigger Trucks. It's pretty clear what their mission is about. CABT. They're opposed to this on safety principles. And so I personally am glad that I am not a legislator that needs to balance all of these conflicting views and come up with what is wise and prudent, but that's the lay of the land.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Now that you mentioned the one for Malheur County, there's a lot of laws like that on the book, and you'd mentioned you're working with the state police on enforcing some of these regulations. Do we do anything to really educate the police? Because I've had several truckers come up to me who've gotten citations for things that were legal, and it seems like with them having to study and get their licenses, they understand the laws better than the police at times. So, because there's like your mileage logbook, if you're staying in the same county, do you have to keep a mileage logbook, or if you're leaving a county, you have to do it? And there's a bunch of little things like that are in place, and I know guys who've gotten tickets that were really doing the correct thing, but it's cheaper for them to pay the ticket than to go fight it.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, I know guys like that too. And I will tell you that, yes, we do work collaboratively with OSP. We do provide training. We do provide materials. There are a lot of people involved, and it's a very large operation. And what we don't hear about is how many times it worked well and how many times they got it right. What you and I tend to hear about from constituents or from members of the regulated industry are those occasions when it hasn't been done well. And so I can tell you that I believe the problem is small, and I can tell you that I believe improvement is being made. And I will also tell you that we have an excellent working relationship with the Patrol Division of Oregon State Police. And whenever any of those are brought to my attention, I have a very welcoming ear when I call Captain Jerry Gregg and explain to him what's happened. He asked for the details. He'll always endeavor to get both sides of the story, understand what happened from the perspective of the involved trooper. But if, in fact, a correction is in order, he always makes it. OSP is a good partner. So I'd simply encourage you, as you become aware of those, I'll leave my card. You give me a call. I'll follow up. It'll get better.
Thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Greg, you mentioned that the Motor Carrier Advisory Committee has been meeting since 1995 to look at regulatory changes. I'm curious if there are any further kind of statutory changes outside of administrative rulemaking that we should be reviewing this session.
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, I mentioned in my overview testimony that one of our 9 points in our safety action plan was to listen up. One of the things we listened up and heard was a need to address some of the current statutory language around mandatory reporting of positive drug tests and the posting of this information on DMV drive records and who's going to report and who's not and where's it going to go and how do you get it, those kinds of things. That notion that was first recommended by staff, we've taken to the Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee. We now have a very strong partnership with the Oregon Trucking Association, who is equally invested in advancing. That will be a huge tool for the enforcement toolbox. And we have worked together to craft a bill which will be coming before the Legislative Assembly. It's already been pre-session filed. It is Senate Bill
126. It was just assigned to Senate Judiciary.
Great.
So that's the one I would call to your attention.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Representative Call.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just briefly, following up on Representative Widener's question, can you? I've been trying to get my head around a bit the scope of ODOT's actual enforcement powers as it pertains to their job and the police function and what you actually have the police do. It seems to me that ODOT has the power to do more enforcement than maybe it is, and was wondering in the kind of safety research that you've done and what you've presented today, if who's doing what job was also something that was investigated, and whether or not you feel like ODOT staff or folks should be doing more enforcement. Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, Representative Call, it might.
good. It's late in the day and it's Friday.
Well, let me just ask you, are you referring to pursuit authority for motor carrier enforcement?
Absolutely, I am. Thank you.
I thought the question might arise. I came prepared to address it.
And that wasn't an attempt at tact, I'll just say. I really am.
I'll make about 5 or 6 quick points. I'll just take a couple of minutes. It's no secret. I have staff, motor carrier enforcement officers, who believe that they should have authority to pursue and make roadside stops and to stop trucks. I have a Department of Justice opinion that rather conclusively indicates they do not have such authority in statute today. And if the department wishes them to have that authority, then a bill needs to be introduced. The question has been asked and answered informally within the department. It's been discussed at Labor Management Committee meetings. Management has indicated that in my opinion, it is an unnecessary authority. Some of the staff have used their rights as citizens to approach their elected representatives and to seek to have the Legislative Assembly substitute its judgment for ours. Fair enough. So the question is it necessary and is it useful? And I would say to you, it's not broken. The ultimate arbiter of the efficacy of the size and weight enforcement program in the state of Oregon is the Federal Highway Administration. In 2004, the director of the department communicated to the Federal Highway Administration that this DOJ opinion had been written and that we endorsed it and believed that it was a non-necessary authority for us to effectively pursue our job. In that same year, the Federal Highway Administrator wrote back, reviewed our information, and submitted a letter to us telling us that he found our program wholly compliant with federal requirements. Moved forward to 2008. I shared with you during my testimony that FHWA came in and did a complete review of the size and weight enforcement operation, and they've recommended us as a best practice and asked us to share our approach nationally. I would tell you that at the time, in various other iterations of the bill as it's been brought before the Legislative Assembly, We have gone so far as to solicit the opinion of the professionals at Oregon State Police and the professionals at the Department of Police Standards Trainings. A DPPST official advised us that if we want our staff to act like police, they need to be trained like police. They need to have training in traffic stops, pursuits, felony stops, and to not provide that level of training is foolish, in this gentleman's opinion, and exposes the department and the state to a liability. I have, if I could ask, there's a briefcase on the corner there, HP briefcase, if someone could bring that up for me. We spoke to the International Association of Police Chiefs. We asked them their opinion about the advisability or the merit, thank you very much, of enabling our staff to perform roadside traffic stops. They responded by supplying me. I happen to have enough copies for them. A DVD entitled Your Vest Won't Stop This Bullet. And it is a presentation for law enforcement officials, and it's graphic, I'll warn you. Police cars have onboard video cameras, and they record the movements of the officers and troopers when they get out of the car as they've made a roadside stop and they're walking up to a truck or a car that they've stopped. I encourage you to take a look at this video, and you're going to see some carnage where the police officers and state troopers have been struck by oncoming traffic. It is real. It is a very real danger. These are people that have been trained. They've gone to an academy. And these people are being killed in the line of duty. And we looked at that, and we thought, you know, we don't understand what additional advantage we'd gain by giving them this authority when we subject them to this kind of danger. So there is a fiscal impact element as well. If you're going to pursue and stop trucks, you've got to have, in addition to training, which is expensive to procure, you have to have appropriate personal protective equipment. Many times when these trucks are stopped, as OSP has done their operation trucker checks, they are stopping vehicles and they are detecting trucks where there is contraband, drug quantities being transported illicitly, where the drivers are compromised, where the drivers are felons, where the drivers have weapons. A state trooper has got training. A state trooper has got personal protective equipment, including a sidearm, a firearm, and the ability to use deadly force in the line of duty. My staff do not. If, in the wisdom of the Legislative Assembly, the size and weight function should be done by police, then perhaps the function should be housed with the police. That's not my judgment. I don't think that that's what's required to have an effective truck size and weight enforcement program. Oregon's approach is not inconsistent with that of other states that utilize commercial enforcement staff who are not police, not highway patrol. It's not one size fits all. Across the 50 states, in some states, the work is done by OSP or by state police. In some states, it's done by police-like folks that have the police training and the sidearms, and they are, in fact, truck police. In other states, it's done by civilian employees, as in Oregon, and our provision of authority is not different than in those states. There is example after example of former ODOT staff who were dismissed from state service after having overreacted and engaged in dangerous and even abusive behaviors when they found themselves in the heat of the chase. You know, I brought, if you're interested, I'd be happy to stop and visit you in your office. But
I think you've I mean, at least to the extent that I asked the question, do you think that the balance of responsibilities between the police and your folks with regards to enforcement and the scope of those duties, how it reflects upon safety, I'm assuming then your answer is that you think that there is an adequate distribution of power between those two groups of people and that our roads are sufficiently safe. So I think my question has been amply answered.
Thank you.
At least from your perspective, so thanks.
Representative Widener.
Madam Chair, Greg, I'm glad you made that clear. I just wanted to add, if a guy goes by the weigh station, or goes by, there's a reason he's going by. And we don't need to have an unarmed person going after that truck. I mean, that's pure insanity, and I don't even think it's something this committee should even consider.
And I'll just add my two cents to it. Nick, you'll probably start getting notices from Greg Hastings, and I don't know what his title is, but he's a top cop in the state, super trooper. He's like the public information person, too, will let you know when there's things happening, like alerts and things like that. But we will often get anecdotal stories, and it's usually having to do with your district. I'm sure I don't get everybody else's district, because they do a lot more than what I hear about. So you'll hear more and more, you'll get those, and they're very interesting, and they send pictures, too, and you need to look at those, and it'll really make what he says clear in some cases. Thank you.
Okay, and I don't see any other questions. So thank you. I appreciate the overview, and I will say I don't know that we'll do it if there was any interest. One of the field trips that I have participated on in the past is a visit to the station, the entry station. And I'm sure that if anybody had any interest, it is very educational. It was a very good tour. But, let me know if there's any interest in that. So I appreciate it. And
Madam Chair, since I'm here, could I make a brief comment? Again, this is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. We work, obviously, very closely with Mr. Delpani and his staff. He's a regulator. And we don't always agree, but he does an outstanding job, and I think he is, as an administrator, one of the examples of how to do it right in state government, and we appreciate what he does very much. And I know a number of you are on his Ways and Means sub, and you'll hear this again from me when we get down to Ways and Means. He really does a very good job.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Okay. I don't necessarily need to close the informational hearing, but I will. And I am going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2233. And, yes, Patrick, would you let us know what we've got?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Members, House Bill 2233 is a bill that was pre-session filed by the Department of Transportation. It increases the required bond for issuance or renewal of commercial driver training school certificates, increases the required insurance coverage for bodily injury or death and for destruction of property for holders of and applicants for commercial driver training school certificates. It also removes the requirement that commercial driver training school certificate holders and applicants comply with insurance requirements in cases where the holder or applicant provides only classroom and theoretical instruction. As per our new 2009 committee rules, you have before you, Madam Chair, in addition to a copy of the bill, you have before you a copy of the fiscal and revenue impact statements. This measure has minimal fiscal impact, minimal expenditure impact, and no revenue impact.
Thank you, Patrick. And we have Tom McClellan from ODOT here on the bill. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. House Bill 2233 is a Department of Transportation bill. You've heard the summary of what it does. I'll cover it briefly. It's not a real complicated bill. It increases the bond requirements and the motor vehicle liability insurance coverage requirements for the owner-operators of commercial driver training schools. It also eliminates the requirement for that insurance for those businesses that don't provide behind-the-wheel training. And there are not many, but there are a few that just do classroom-only training. And it didn't make sense that they'd be required to have the insurance on vehicles if they're not using the vehicles for their business. So that's also part of this bill. Current statute requires, and this was set back in the 1960s, so it's been a long time. Current statute is a bond of $2,500. We are proposing to increase that to $10,000. That amount was determined in checking with other states, what is current practice in other states, surrounding states. $10,000 was really the minimum that states were requiring of these driver training schools. Some have it as high as $25,000. So there's an upper end to this. We thought from $2,500 to $10,000 is a reasonable amount to increase for consumer protection, if nothing else, to have that amount. We've recently checked the price for a bond of this type. It's $100 for a $2,500 bond. It's about $200 for a $10,000 bond. So it doubles the cost. Still not a significant cost to the operator of that business, but it is an increase in cost for them. The vehicle liability insurance coverages, again, set 40 years ago. We are proposing that those go to the next level. They're doubling, but it's actually the next level as far as insurance coverage goes. So we're going from $50,000 for bodily injury to or death of one person to $100,000. The bodily injury for more than one person from $100,000 to $300,000, and the injury to or destruction of property from $25,000 to $50,000. That's just the next level higher. We believe that's appropriate considering the risks involved with the persons who are operating vehicles in a training mode. So we believe it's a prudent amount to require of these operators of these schools. That, in a nutshell, is what the bill does. So I'm open for questions if you have any.
I don't know. Representative,
just a comment. I recently spent overnight in the emergency department, and my bill, when it finally came in, was nearly $9,000. And that was for no apparent injury. And I'm thinking of surgeries and emergency department costs, surgeries, which likely would be in a crash, if you're mm-hmm. what you're talking about, and ICU care, et cetera. I think the hospital bills for things like that can go upwards of $50,000-$60,000, and mm-hmm. it wouldn't cover.
Representative Widener.
If Representative Boone, if you look below the bodily injury and stuff below is much higher. So the bodily injury and all of that that's covered if someone was to get hurt.
Yeah, no, that's why I said it went from 50,000 to 100. I'm guessing good, strong orthopedic surgery could run up 40,000 or more.
Which this, to me, makes more than perfect sense because when I walk into a mill, I have to have 2 million just on my auto to drive onto a plant. So.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Berger. Sorry, I'm getting used to all this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, how many commercial driver schools are there in the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, we have currently 23. I think 2 years ago we had about 27. So it's not a...
And that's of both categories, those with driver and those with classroom only?
There are very few that provide just classroom only. The two that come to mind are actually not in business today. So there may be others that are out there.
Because they had all this insurance to buy on vehicles.
It could be. I'm not sure.
Another question, Madam Chair. I don't have any trouble with any of this, by the way. Okay. Makes sense to me. The only other question I have is if once they graduate from school and they get behind a commercial truck, what is the insurance requirement there? Is it different from the one they were driving when they were in school? And do we regulate that?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, these insurance requirements are for the owner of the school itself, not for the driver. So it's
on the truck that they're, or is it the school?
It's the school for any vehicle that they use in their business to do behind-the-wheel training. So you go to the business and say, I want to learn how to drive.
Yeah, I understand that, but what are the requirements? So they get a job with a company that has trucks. What are their insurance requirements? Are they different than these?
This is a confusing thing for me, is that I had trouble with this bill in who it covered. I mean, who these training schools are covering.
Mm-hmm.
And these are student drivers. They're not actually commercial vehicle drivers. Is that part of your...
My question is, what is the insurance regulation of a truck on the road? I mean, I'm required to have insurance on my car. Mm-hmm. What's the truck insurance regulations? I don't even know.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Berger, and I actually don't know what the insurance is for a truck, what's required. I could find that out for you, but
so this
I don't know what...
This is liability on a school,
mm-hmm.
which presumably covers the driver or the school, or, I mean, the driver also has to have insurance. I mean, who and what are we insuring here?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, it's the vehicle used for the training. And in this case, the vehicle used for the training is owned by the school.
So it's really the vehicle. If they don't have a vehicle, there's no insurance requirement, exactly. So it's really the vehicle. So my question then is, if you had a vehicle that wasn't being used for a school but was being used in a commercial venue, what are the insurance requirements? And somebody can get back to me. It isn't important. I was just want to make a comparison. I mean, it is important in some sense. Is it different? Is it more because they're in training than you would require once they're not trained and they're driving down the street in Del Ponte's shop? Does that make sense, the question?
Yeah. Patrick?
He left.
Yeah.
He probably would know.
Tom, can I ask you a quick question? I had some confusion when I was writing this measure summary, but I figured we're meeting today and I could ask you here. The term commercial driver training school can be taken one of a couple ways. It's one of two things, and I'm not sure which one it is. Is it a driver training school that's run as a commercial enterprise, or is it a school that trains commercial drivers? And I think it's the first.
It's the former.
Which would be like teaching 16-year-olds how to drive their passenger vehicle, not necessarily training people to drive commercial vehicles for a CDL license.
Well, that's what I
meant. And that's what I didn't know the answer to that either, but that was...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, these schools are not training people to be truck drivers, to operate buses. These are people like you and me that may have never driven and would like to learn how. And so you go to this business.
We got that.
A commercial business who does driver training. It does get confusing.
Just have to know how to ask the question right.
Yeah, so, now I get
Representative Shuffler.
It's just driver's ed.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, a business that prefers... Are we in a work session, or are you seeking a motion?
We're in a public hearing. I haven't gone to a work session. And if there's somebody ready to make a motion, we can close the public hearing, unless there are more questions.
I know what it is, Madam Chair. It's that you forgot the comma. I'm kidding.
Oh.
You know how commas can change the meaning? A little levity, sorry.
Okay, no other questions about the bill. I'm going to close the public hearing, and we can go to a work session.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 2233, the floor, to pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Shoffler has moved House Bill 2233 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments?
Yeah, one. I hope it's made clear on the floor.
would you
send Representative Shoffler to say driver's ed?
Yes.
I'll speak to the bill. It's Friday, and I'm ready to vote, Madam Chair.
All right. And I guess the question is, maybe we can do this easy. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the bill passes. And we'll need to assign someone to carry the bill.
I think some of them, you guys.
Unless,
do it.
What are our rules on consent calendar?
Madam Chair, since Representative Shoffler was so quick to point out his driver's ed, I think he would be an appropriate carrier.
Well, Madam Chair, I...
Clearly understand.
I think Representative Bailey just got out of driver's ed, didn't he?
Madam Chair, having driven with Representative Bailey, I can attest to the fact that he has not had driver's ed.
Yes, Madam Chair, I don't care who carries this bill, but you probably need to know that I'm a real hard sell on consent calendar.
Okay. That's good. Good to know. And, you know, it's early. We can, you know, we need some bills on the floor anyway, right? So maybe, unless anybody has any objections, we'll get let one of the freshmen have a chance to carry this bill. And I can go
eeny,
meeny, miny, moe, alphabetical. I guess we'll go with Jules.
Nice, Jules.
I'll do it if you don't.
Congratulations.
little does he know.
When you point a finger at somebody else, you point back at you.
I did close the work session, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The work session is closed, and the committee is over for today. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll see you Monday.